Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me this week, we've got regular contributor Kelly Powell, returning special guest Josh Slater-Williams, and despite the sun coming out and melting our memories of the snow, our very own beast from the East London, Sam Howlett's here too. It seems in a strange distribution deal left over from Disney merging with 20th Century Fox that despite Avengers Infinity War coming out this week, we're also discussing Kelsey Grammer's X-Men spin-off Beast this week. Isn't that right, Sam?
No, Jake, you've got it completely wrong.
What?
This is actually about Beast as in the prince that was turned into a beast from Beauty and the Beast.
It's
his solo movie.
Right, and Josh, you were saying it's also a prequel to Beastly.
Yes, I definitely said that.
Yeah, great. It's a lot
going on. Oh, wait, no, sorry, guys. This is actually a biopic of Mark Levett, who is nicknamed the Beast on the TV quiz show The Chase.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay.
Oh, wait, no, sorry. It's actually a biopic of the famous Jamaican Olympic runner, Johan Blake, who was also nicknamed the Beast.
There's a lot going on. It's a busy film.
Sorry, our notes were all over the place this week.
Yeah.
No!
Right.
I think the president's car is also called the Beast. Is that right? Is
anyone that's the end of the podcast. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
I think that's right.
Yeah, maybe. Sam, what is Beast?
Beast is actually about Moll, played by Jessie Buckley, who is 27 and still living at home on the island of Jersey. And she's stifled by the small island community around her until she meets Pascal, a free-spirited stranger who makes her feel alive for the first time, and she falls madly in love. However, a deranged serial killer is stalking the island, and Mull's new beau might not be all he seems, forcing her to make some decisions that will change her life forever.
It's amazing you just came up with that.
I know, just right off the top of my head.
So much passion. Right, so Michael Pearce, this is a debut film. He's He kind of got highlighted last year in the Guardian as one of 20 British directors to keep an eye on. And Josh, you've seen the film twice now in cinemas, been to a Q&A. This is an exciting guy to be keeping an eye on, yeah?
Definitely, yeah. I was personally very impressed with the film. And also, well, actually, funny thing at the Q&A, he says that the actor's getting so much praise that, you know, he said this in jest, obviously, that, you know, he's getting completely ignored. but yeah, very fine two central performances as well, particularly from Jessie Buckley, who I don't believe I'd seen before in anything, but I believe is currently on television in The Woman in White.
So I didn't know anything about Jessie Buckley. She was in she was one of the finalists in the BBC's I'd Do Anything talent show to find the cast of Oliver.
I think I watched that, actually.
Did you?
Mm. Oh. I don't really remember her, sorry. But
she was a finalist, mate.
She was a finalist, yeah. Right.
Fun fact, the bit in this film where she eats dirt, that's actually just old audition footage from that show.
I remember the dirt eating. That was episode 4. Yeah. Everyone has to eat dirt in front of Andrew Lloyd Webber. Whoever eats the most dirt without dying wins. And she got to the final.
Oh, yeah. And Michael Pearce just was watching that
8 years ago. You know, some things just stay with you as a director.
Yeah.
And yeah, just sunk in. Yeah. Sunk in the dirt.
Okay. yeah, she was also in War and Peace and Tom Hardy's Taboo, which, again, I have not seen.
Tom and also his father, Chips Hardy.
Yes, not forgetting Chips Hardy.
This is true. Tom Hardy's dad is called Chips.
Oh, no. Yeah,
it's not a nickname.
Wonderful stuff. Yeah, so we've got an interview with Michael Pearce, which you led, Sam, and we'll be hearing that in a little bit. But before we go to the interview and get into our review, kind of initial reactions to this film, Kelly?
Yeah, I really liked it. I really liked it. I thought it was a really strong first feature.
Mm. And yeah, there's definitely a real confidence to
it. Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I thought it was a clever film. I think well-paced. I don't know why I'm obsessed with pacing at the moment. Anyway, it's well-paced, well-acted. You know, like, it draws you in. It wasn't too on the nose with anything, I think.
Mm.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and it is it's kind of inspired from this folklore around during his childhood, because the Beast of Jersey, who was a serial sex attacker, actually stalked the island in which the film is set during the 60s. So when he's growing up in the 80s, these stories are passed along about this beast. And so he's brought that tale to the modern age and has kind of thrown Jesse Buckley's mole into the maelstrom that the Beast has created on this secluded island. But that's enough of us talking about it for now. Shall we pass over to Michael?
And we're delighted to welcome on the Curzon Film Podcast Michael Pearce, writer-director of Beast. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start by asking about the title, because I noticed that that in France this is going to be called The Jersey Affair, which is a bit of a more conventional title for this kind of film. So I just wanted to ask, when did you decide upon calling it Beast, and what does that title mean for you, for this film, for this story?
So the film's loosely inspired by a true crime case that happened in Jersey in the 60s. There was a guy called the Beast of Jersey.
Right.
And so it was kind of a working title from the very beginning, because I just, you know, that's what the loose inspiration was. And the film kind of sort of developed very differently from that story, but continued to be more resonances with the title. Like, halfway through developing the script, I realised in some ways it was like a fairy tale. You know, it's an innocent, seemingly innocent young woman trapped within a seemingly wholesome family, and she ventures into the woods and she meets a character that might be Prince Charming or might be the Big Bad Wolf.
Yeah, okay.
And so, you know, that kind of stuck with that. And then I was, as we were getting closer to shooting the film, I, you know, was continuing to work on the script, and I really wanted to layer in this idea of looking at the characters through the prism of their species.
Okay.
And that these are animals just having to navigate more complicated moral predicaments.
Yeah.
And so there's also like an animal layer in there as well.
Sure.
And I think with regard to the French title, I don't know whether La Bête was too strong for how they wanted market to their audiences, so they changed it.
Yeah, okay. Obviously, it's not your decision, I suppose, things like that.
No, but yeah. we had some kind of consultation on it.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I don't know that, they know French distribution better than I do.
Okay. So you've worked on short films before, you've worked in television. And for your debut film, was this always going to be your debut film? Were there other things you thought about doing as a feature before this?
I had like eight other ideas that I was looking to be the first feature. And in some ways I saw this as like maybe the second one, because it was that much more ambitious.
Yeah.
And the other ones were like more micro-budget scripts. But, you know, I was working on, it was 10 years between graduating from film school and this moment. And at some point, some ideas, they're not rich enough that you're going to stay in love with them for that period of time.
Okay.
And I think, Beast was, and I continue to find more layers of interest in it. And I think also partly because it's inspired by the place that I'm from. And I grew up on the island, and it's loosely inspired by this true case that kind of had an impact on my childhood imagination, and so it was an opportunity to go back to the island and sort of explore those feelings and those impressions that I had growing up there.
Can we talk a bit about the fact that it's Jersey then? So it's the place where you grew up. It's not a place we see in film that often. What is it about Jersey for you that makes it a cinematic landscape?
I think when I first found out about these crimes, this Beast of Jersey guy, it was I think it had a big impact on me because it seemed so incongruous, the like how horrific those crimes were against how safe and scenic and quaint my, you know, Jersey seemed. It was like a kind of picturesque fairy tale environment. And you know, traditionally in like a psychological thriller or psychological horror, you draw tension from the landscape. And I thought, oh, maybe it's more interesting that we use it as a kind of contrast, as the canvas that seemed, it's actually the opposite of what's happening in terms of these crimes. And that seemed quite unique. And it felt like we could embrace it more as the canvas for the love story. And, you know, I talked a lot with my head of department about it feeling like a kind of... We wanted the film to feel enchanting.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, so... and then I just had so many sort of personal experiences that I try to feed into the film, whether that's, like, running through the waves as they hit in the seawall or, you know, going through those landscapes that... It just, I think if you have a strong feeling about a location when you film it, somehow that feeling is transmitted on screen. And if we shot this in the Isle of Man where I don't have any connection to, that was a suggestion at one point because there's lots of incentives to shoot there financially. I don't know if it would have had the same sort of emotions.
And so are we seeing on screen a lot of places that you grew up seeing, a lot of places from your childhood, things like that?
Yes, but we can only shoot a week there because it was so expensive.
Yeah.
So we had to be very smart about which scenes were set there. And so most of the big exterior locations are shot on the island.
Right.
It was a long, I think we shot there for maybe 8 or 9 days. We did a few extra days, so it's like a long week. And the nightclub she goes to at the beginning is where I used to go.
The Wipeout.
Yeah, it's actually called the Water Splash, but for legal reasons we had to change it. And that beach that she walks on afterwards was like the beach that I grew up surfing.
Okay.
Those bunkers that scatter the coastline is, you know, that's all. Yeah, that's the west coast of the island that I know really, really well.
Okay.
So it's all a lot of that's sort of layered into the script.
And as well as. Intrigued by the time period of the film, because there's nothing that really dates it that much. There's no mobile phones or anything like that, and as well there are no references either. I mean, you've got modern cars and like televisions and things like that, but this could be anywhere in the past, maybe 10 or 20 years. Can you talk about that decision?
Yeah, I mean that's something of the Channel Islands that they're, you know,
right.
I mean, now not so much, but when I was growing up, a lot of the bars were like, they hadn't been changed since the 70s or 80s. And I was then going back to that feeling that it felt like a place that was stuck in time. But it was also, we wanted to create a kind of timeless universe because we felt it would be a better way for the sort of fairy tale and fable-like atmosphere of the film to resonate from. You know, there'd been so many TV shows and films that were about, I don't know, a serial killer, and they felt very contemporary, and it was about procedure and different sorts of, you know, the clue is in the mobile, the text that they sent from their iPhone. And it was just, you know, we never wanted to make a film that was about, you know, the procedure or the case or the investigation. It was like, it was a love story trapped within this kind of nightmarish scenario, and we wanted to elicit all of those. We wanted it to feel, you know, Badlands was a closer reference for me than a lot of these other sort of crime films and TV shows. So it was a way to sort of delineate itself from those other works.
I guess it adds to this kind of almost dreamlike aspect of the film as well. This guy, you don't know when it is and things like that. I think if you tell someone that the simplest version of the plot of this film, it could sound like this could easily be sort of BBC Sunday night drama. But even like the procedural stuff, that doesn't seem quite as procedural as we expect it to be in the film. And did you kind of push back on things like that? Like the investigation, even this the interrogation scene when the lights go down and things like that,
yeah.
Are they thrown in there to kind of throw the audience off as well?
I mean, partly when working within a genre, you kind of, it's a game of what you deliver in terms of giving the goods of the genre and what's expected, and then partly what you reinvent, what you subvert, what you just completely circumvent and you don't do. And with each of these kind of familiar tropes, it was like a question of how much do we engage with it, how much do we try and flip it. Same with the interrogation scene. You know, they're scenes that are so full of tropes. You know, since film noir, up until recent TV shows, and it's like we tried to think of it more as a psychological space.
Okay.
So you know, she is being interrogated in a school, and I mean, it's a nuance that's probably lost on a lot of audiences unless they like rewatch the film and keenly look at it. But it's also like, you know, the school is where she committed a crime in her youth.
Yeah.
You know, and we wanted the person, the detective interrogating her, not to be the kind of grizzled 50-year-old sort of male detective. You know, I was looking for someone that worked within the kind of the archetype of a fairy tale. This was the wise woman that was warning the protagonist not to go deeper into the forest. You know, this was the platform. I thought so we did a lot of these approaches were just to like, move it away from the tropes, you know, in terms of casting, in terms of lighting. Let's have this be this is someone that's not interrogating, you know, where she was on the night. You know, that's not the important thing. It's interrogating her moral character. Mm. You know, we've got to sort of dive into that, and using these other sort of techniques or ways to sort of move it away just from those cliches, but still deliver the moment of having an interrogation, which felt legitimate for this story.
Sure. Let's talk about casting a bit then. So Moll is in every scene. And she's in, you know, most of the shots as well. And she's very shut off from the audience, even though we're with her so much. Her motives are so sort of ambiguous. So it's quite an important character, of course. What was it about Jesse Buckley that you felt like she could really deliver Moll to us?
There's something very... Jesse's like very grounded and unfussy and just... She's got a very empathetic energy as a person. It's very easy to get along with her because there's no like airs or graces or and it kind of struck me when I was meeting her for the auditions that she was the type of person Moll might become if she lived under different circumstances. You know, if she was allowed to just be spirited and just like make mistakes, and that she could turn into someone like Jesse, you know. And I thought, well, that's interesting if we have Jesse in the film and we have her hemmed in by this family and by certain codes of behavior. So it was partly like a marriage of just like the character and the person, but also Jesse as an actress, is she has a very uncanny ability to summon very deep and rich emotions in a, you know, within a matter of seconds, and the character goes on a very, you know, she kind of dives into a hurricane. It's a very big and grand love story, the first love she's ever had. But also, it's like it's a really treacherous journey she goes on. And so we needed an actor that was going to be kind of fearless in, like, you know, looking at, you know, all of those dimensions. And Jesse, she turns it on in, like, you say action and it's there straight away. It was such... I mean, it was great for me as a director because it set the bar so high for all other casts and all crew. Because they witnessed her on the first take of the first scene giving so much. It meant everyone just had to really give a shit because she was really going there.
And then Pascal as well, Johnny Flynn, he's someone that needs to be mysterious but also this kind of likeable, amiable character that you're kind of not sure how much you trust. Did you see that instantly in him when he auditioned?
I couldn't quite see him in the role when my casting director, Julie Harkin, had... Because I knew him from his music a bit.
Right, okay.
I really like him, and I knew him from a few of his performances, but I couldn't quite see him having that, you know, big moral ambiguity. And it's my casting director got me a ticket to go and see him in The Hangman, the Martin McDonagh play, which he's now doing in Broadway. And it was a very... Yeah, it was like a transformative performance. I don't know if you've seen it, but he really goes to, like...
Yeah.
You know, he's a kind of sociopath in it.
Right,
but also a very charismatic one. And I came away from that thinking about, Pascal as a character and how we wanted him to be a kind of shapeshifter and a bit of a chameleon and have these different shades. And, you know, that he should be... Because he's kind of the romantic lead in the film. He's the potential antagonist.
Yeah.
He's someone that, you know, sometimes he's like a big cat stalking his prey. Sometimes he's quite wounded and vulnerable. I thought it was Johnny's got a very particular presence on screen where he can, his face changes quite dramatically. Yeah. He's quite boyish, and then he can be quite sinister, and then he's the handsome leading man. Yeah. And it just seems so interesting to play with that through the movie, and through playing with Moll's perception of him and the audience's perception.
I think for this story to work, you've really got to sell their relationship. Like, was there a lot of workshopping between the two of them, or was it just very natural on set that came off?
We did one chemistry read between the two of them, and they got on really well.
Yeah.
Just from, and not in a forced way, because they wanted it to work. It was just quite natural that they, they're like good buddies now. And then we didn't do tons of rehearsal. We didn't really have that much time when we were in pre-production. But we did. I was talking to a lot of them, talking to both of them a lot individually, sharing movies and books and ideas, other backstories for their characters. So they were kind of, we're tuning in to each other's frequency. And then we went to the three of us went to Jersey together, and I showed them the locations and also like where I grew up and where some of the film was inspired by. So we were like, it's not that we went through scene by scene and rehearsed. The value was really sort of getting to know each other and getting to know them as people and, sort of sharing ideas. And it's a very collaborative experience. Also on the shoot, because they're not just looking to execute, you know, one preconceived idea.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have just one preconceived idea. Or what, you know, the set should be a creative space where we're constantly trying to find an extra nuance or layer, you know, and they love that, you know, and that meant my ideas were continually like enlivened because they were so proactive and trying to like just keep it alive and keep it interesting.
So the film premiered at was it Toronto?
Yes.
And what is it like showing your debut feature to an audience at a major film festival for the first time?
Terrifying. I think they should give out Valium to first time directors at a film festival, because you're really nervous, partly because of the audience reaction, partly because it's the first time, you know, press are seeing it, and that there's going to be reviews and they're going to be released as soon as the credits go up, you can't not be aware that it is going to dictate to some degree what your standing is and your stock value and what, you know, it's not what you obsess over, but it's like it's a big aspect of your first movie going out there. So you're kind of neurotic, but you're trying to enjoy the experience. And then we had a really good reception in Toronto, both within the room, like people really responded in a way that was better than I could have imagined in some ways. It was a very warm reception. Like the jokes, the laughs and gasps and silences were in the right place. And then the reviews were, you know, were pretty positive as well. So we kind of, it felt like a soft landing in terms of the first feature, and so we were kind of cushioned by that, and then now it goes out to the wider world and it's under even more scrutiny. But you know, it's that's just part of the game now, I guess. Like, I'm curious, if anything, just to see what people make of it.
And we get a lot of directors on the podcast that have their films part of the festival circuit, and I'm always intrigued what it's like to do that, like to kind of, you know, tour with a film. Like, do you go to all the places where the film is playing? Do you watch the film every time? What is that experience like, touring the film?
I've done quite a lot of festivals with shorts, which was great, and you get to meet so many filmmakers.
Yeah.
And so for this, it wasn't just so much to go to a festival and see movies and meet. It was to support the film and be there for the Q&As and for press. And I was very curious to see what the different reactions were in different countries. So I went to not all, but a lot of them, Toronto and Sundance and Thessaloniki and Macau, and it was actually, there comes a point though after like 6 months where you feel burnt out by that, and you're, you know, which seems strange because of course all the festivals are incredibly nice to you and you're taken care of, but you start to feel guilty that you're not working on your next film. So it's kind of, you can, I think the first few months of doing it is great because it's the first time you're sharing it with the world, but then some kind of fatigue or guilt sets in. And I found it very hard to work on your next script on, you know, in a plane or in a hotel room. I can you know, answer a few emails and that's about it.
And so you graduated from NFTS, and I know a few people that go there, and you went back to do a Q&A for The Beast, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it like to return there with this film?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed quite a lot since okay. I was there 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of new buildings there now, and lots more courses and lots right. more students.
Yeah.
But it was still, it was great to, I thought I would make a feature like within a year or two of graduating. So in some ways, when I showed the film, I kind of wanted to give. I didn't want to scare the students off, but I wanted to give them what my process was, and how, you know, why it took me so long, and you know how tough and ruthless and competitive it is, and because. Yeah, I think those insights were like so useful when I was at film school, and it would be great when a big director came in, and you'd get some interesting anecdotes of when they made their big, you know, great movie. But it was also I was really interested in seeing like filmmakers that had graduated and made their first feature. So I was just trying to share as much as possible with the students, and get that. I mean, it's one particular journey. I'm sure other people have done it, like in a shorter space of time. But I really enjoyed my time at the film school, and you know, I was there for 2 years. And you walk through the gate every day, and you're making short films, and you're meeting other passionate filmmakers. And I loved it. So it was quite special to go back.
Yeah, and it's gotten bigger, isn't it? With the it won the BAFTA for like contribution to British film this year, and Alex Garland is now in charge of things over there.
Yes, I think someone said it was the best film school in the world. I don't know how they use how they measure that, but it's really it's grown every year. It seems to have a new building added to it, and more students
and you mentioned their work about, you know, a next project or a next film. Do you have anything locked in yet, or is it still are you taking too much of your time doing these kind of junkets?
No, I've got there's a couple of projects I'm attached to. One set in New York, which I didn't write, which is great because I think writing's a hard part. And I'm looking for my Paul Schrader to do that bit. And it's a story about a young woman who becomes a content moderator.
Okay.
And as she's exposed to these, you know, the very extreme, you know, darkest recesses of the internet, she decides to take revenge on the people uploading this material. Okay. So it's another kind of female-driven psychological thriller, but used in a very different landscape. As opposed to Jersey, we're going to be New York, so, which is great because it's the most romantic kind of landscape, but also like how do you shoot New York in a way that it hasn't been done before?
Sure,
you know, it's also like there's a challenge there, and there's something else that I'm working on that's, funnily enough, that's also set in the States.
Okay. So you've gone to Hollywood?
Not yet. I'm actually looking for projects set in the UK as well. But it just so I think I'm very curious to work with like US talent and to shoot in that landscape. But I'm not moving out there in the near future.
Great, Michael Pierce. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I think there's something really interesting he talks about how if you just hear the plot, this could very easily be your first assumption is that this is just a very standard, run-of-the-mill, almost televisual crime drama.
Yeah.
And those were my thoughts as well when I first read the plot. And I think it's got enough sort of muted style and intelligence that elevates it above that because when you first hear, oh, it's set on Jersey, it's about small town murder, you think, oh, this sounds exactly like Midsummer Murders.
No, this sounds like Mindhorn.
It does sound like Mindhorn.
Yeah. Like even an island off of the mainland, or Hot Fuzz or something.
Yeah. Either a comedy like that or something that everyone has seen before. Mm. And I think it manages to, you know, pay attention to the darker aspects of those stories to not be those stories.
Right, and it's not super interested in the plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's more interested in building that mood and getting into the psyche of someone who in a traditional murder story is going to be a side character.
Yeah.
This is not the police's story. This is not about the investigation. This is someone who is part of it.
It's not about the killer either. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's about a woman who's unfortunately been sort of dragged up in this case. But yeah, you're right. It's not procedural and it's not about a man on the run.
And although related to that, although it is sort of a mystery, it's not really a mystery because Pascal is pretty much the only subject we really become familiar with in any way, other than the kind of dream implications that Moll could be doing it herself, maybe. Mm. But those dream sequences reminded me a little bit, I'm curious if anyone else felt this, of another recent release, Lynn Ramsey's You're Never Really Here, in some way.
Yeah.
Particularly one, I can't recall if it's a hammer, but that's kind of a blow to the head in particular,
yeah,
which made someone shout "ow" very loud the second time I saw it. And then at the end of the Q&A, Jesse Buckley suddenly pointed to this person and affectionately laughed and said, I was really amused by how you like hurt your head. But it was hilarious because no one else in the crowd was laughing at this, except for, I think, the person who was being addressed and me. So I'm like, oh, did we all the three of us just collectively imagine this because no one else is responding? And the actress who played the person everyone thinks is crazy now seems crazy.
And I think that's what You Were Never Really Here did about this kind of... It wasn't in that, it was in Dark River. Clive Barnard had a really lovely way of not saying flashbacks, and it was like invasive memories.
Invasive memory, yeah.
And I think You Were Never Really Here plays on that. These traumatizing events can come back in a very fragmented and destructive way that you can't really control. And I think we're looking back into the editing on Beast as well. They're using that to portray how damaging those thoughts can be, rather than just using it as a way to give context.
Yeah, and we're told, we know fairly early on that Moll has a dark past, but it takes a long time to actually reveal specifically what that is. And I know that they, although they do, because in You Never Really Hear, we were never really told anything about Joaquin Phoenix's dark past. We just know it happened.
Mm.
But here, yeah, it still takes that time for you to get to know the character before you know her history, which is an interesting technique.
Yeah. We empathise with her, I think, a lot more in the beginning.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I think, and as you get a bit more distant from her as she goes a bit further down the rabbit hole of this romance and this crime.
Which is interesting because she is, well, first of all, she is the lead character, but she's a proper lead character in that she's in every scene. She's in almost like every shot as well.
Yeah.
You're fully with her all the way through, even though you know so little about her.
Yeah. It's almost like a... like an untrustworthy narrator. Okay. What do you call it?
Yeah.
Unreliable.
Yeah. Unreliable narrator. Mm. Yeah, it's almost like that. Like, you don't know whether or not you can trust her.
Well, let's dive into those performances. So, in an interview last year, Michael Pierce said, I think it was Elia... sorry. Am I going to go Elia or Elia?
Elia.
Elia.
That's
well,
how
that's how they...
Elia. Michael Pierce said, I think it was Elia Kazan who said that 50% of a director's job is casting, and although he said that the maths may have not been Kazan's strong suit, you get the point. And I think I can see why he's making those comments in that, although jokingly in that Q&A, Josh, about Jesse Buckley and Johnny Flynn getting all that praise and no one's talking about, no one wants to hear about Michael Pierce.
Who?
Some guy.
I can't believe I interviewed an empty chair.
But you can see why that's happening, because these two lead performances are so strong. We've mentioned Jesse Buckley quite a bit. Let's give a background on Johnny Flynn, shall we?
South African born.
Really?
Yeah, do you not know that?
I didn't know that.
I'm kind of obsessed with him.
Really?
Yeah, I really
he's a bit
like
of a
him.
Heartthrob, and I didn't realise
this. I really like
this.
Him.
Because, I watched the film with my girlfriend who had just binge-watched all of Lovesick
as
well.
Lovesick is amazing. I loved it.
Don't you love Johnny Flynn in it?
Oh, yes. I do.
Oh, isn't he so rugged and talented?
Mm, I love him.
He's a little bit Hunnamy, no?
He's got a bit of a touch of the Hunnam.
Charlie Hunnamy?
Yeah, a little bit.
Bit of the Hun man?
Well, he's also a very talented musician.
Yes.
Which I appreciate.
You know when it was really cool to see Mumford & Sons?
No.
Yeah, because that was a cool thing to do that people did. That cool.
Oh, yeah, back in the day.
Yeah, when that was cool. Well, and he was the first support to Mumford & Sons when I saw them. And, you know, he was fine. And then, like, 8 years later, here he is.
Yeah. Is he a solo artist or is he in a band?
It's like the most twee kind of modern folk band name. It's like Johnny Flynn and the Sussex Wit.
Yes.
Oh, my.
I take it back. I hate this movie.
Don't be hating.
Are they good?
I like them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen them live, but.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just all about his acting now, isn't it?
Like, that's yeah, what I think he's taken a change of.
Yeah, so people might know him from Lovesick, which was originally Scrotal Recall.
Much
on
better
Channel 4.
Name.
Why would you change that? Yeah. It's so good.
Netflix, man.
Yeah. But he was also in Clouds of Sils Maria and played the young Genius. Albert Einstein in Genius. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I saw it.
Is it good?
Yeah, I really liked it.
Because I've just noticed there's posters on the bus for a new one.
There's the Picasso one with Antonio next. Banderas.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Every season focuses on a different genius. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was quite good.
Yeah. Isn't Ron Howard involved in it somehow?
He is, yeah.
Yeah, he directed the first episode and I think he was involved in producing
it. And Mitch Glazer as well from... Because they're both involved in Arrested Development.
Mm. Right.
That may be completely false.
Okay. Well, he got some Critics' Choice Awards for his young Albert Einstein, which is really interesting and definitely because I really can't imagine that. So that makes me... I've never really been interested in watching that show and then reading that.
Yeah.
That's now more of a curiosity than anything else. But Johnny Flynn is good in this and he manages to take quite a volatile character and actually make him not just a caricature.
Mm. Yeah, it's a very actory performance. In that he's there's a lot of sort of squirming and he's doing a lot of kind of like tics and a lot of just doing a lot, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
there's a lot to his performance. In the interview, Michael Pierce talks about how this is partly a fairy tale, like a dark modern real fairy tale, and I'm trying to work out what character in the fairy tale Pascal could be, because at first he's the prince that comes and whisks away the girl in the tower, but also he's the rugged, the huntsman, but also he's the monster in the woods.
Maybe he's the beast, Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah? Hey?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Because
that's what it's like. Who's the beast is the film's question.
I think the answer to that, Jake, is that we're all the beast. There's a beast in every man.
Yes.
Well, and he awakens the beast in her, I think, as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of beasts and a lot of awakenings.
What if the real beast is... love.
Well, you say that as a joke, and you said that in Phantom Thread as well, but there is arguably that is genuinely a point in this, that of their kind of destructive love actually creating like quite violent ends. These violent delights do have violent ends, someone might say.
Mm-hmm.
Someone might.
Yes, related to the dark fairy tale point, I think Pascal, because he's that blend, you describe him as like Prince Bad Wolf in a way. He's the Prince Charming, but he's also the monster. But you can also apply it to other characters, like Geraldine James is the arguably wicked stepmother character, even though she's the biological mother. But whereas the kind of, I guess maybe it's a stretch to call him a suitor, but there's this detective character called Clifford, played by Tristan Gravel is his name or something like that, who's got this kind of wolfish look to him. I don't know if anyone else kind of agree with that description, but I feel like Michael Pierce mentioned in the Q&A because apparently he did audition for Pascal.
Right.
And that was sort of the kind of look they originally envisioned for the character. One thing I quite liked relating to the fairy tale thing, there's this little visual cue. So at one point, Mole invites Pascal to do some kind of work in their garden. So he fixes a bench and some patio slabs. But when he comes in the house and starts smoking, as he comes in, there's footage of a crocodile on the television, like consuming, I believe it's consuming a little creature, which kind of made me think of like Peter Pan, but also just like, you know, it literally, the snap kind of happens just as he comes in through the garden, outside garden door into the house, which is quite a nice little trick. Actually, related to the whole kind of wolf thing I mentioned, whose idea was it to call this Beast, and considering the lead character, not call it Ginger Snaps?
Hey. Yeah,
just saying.
Sam, there was the great French title for this as well. No.
Yeah, in France, this will be called The Jersey Affair, which sounds not great.
I mean, that, like, going back to your idea of this sounding like a BBC Sunday night.
Yeah, this could be BBC One 8 p.m. on a Sunday night, just after Call the Midwife or something.
Yeah.
It's The Jersey Affair tonight.
What, going back to what you were saying about the crocodile just in the back of the room on the telly, I think that's kind of tribute to Michael Pierce's fascination with details. It's not just following the characters and their reactions. He's really building a sense of a mood and a place, and that comes from building up these little details to get that location, and or even just the fact that he's rolling licorice rollies rather than normal ones.
Yeah,
you just get like, and that just makes him a little bit cooler,
And he's
more of a renegade.
And he smokes inside. Like, I think I quite like this idea of like bringing the outside in and disrupting the suburban sort of conservative family. Yeah. You know, unit which she never belonged to anyway, and there's a lot of like dirt coming in, coming in. You know,
I was surprised at how shocked I was just at the thought of someone coming into your house who you don't know and just starting smoking.
Yeah, I know.
I had the same reaction.
Yeah,
and I was just like, oh, he didn't even ask.
Yeah, exactly. But it is this kind of like disruption. It's like a blatant disregard for that sort of family. That sort of space.
Well, yeah, and you can totally see his act, like the fact that she's never felt really connected to that home when she sees someone who comes in and just does that. You can imagine for her why that is so attractive.
And she feels all throughout, which I think is a testament to her performance, but she does feel this sort of like wild, untamed force that's like been repressed her whole life, and has this darkness lurking in the background because of her past, and he kind of brings that out of her. I think it's ambiguous to whether, I mean, it's obviously, it's dark, so it has negative connotations, but I also think it's like, it awakens this force in her that's empowering as well, you know? This almost like particularly feminine sort of at once vulnerable and at the same time like wild and strong sort of, which is also folklore-y, you know, that harkens back to like this mythic.
Yeah, and like you're getting really into fairy tale imagery of just like basic duality of his costume and her costume, and there's a bit where everyone's like in their middle class linen suits for a fair, and Pascal just rocks up black t-shirt, black jeans, and that's such a plain outfit, but in that context he just looks like Satan. And like they reacting to him as if he is as well. He's just such this unknown quantity for them, and no one knows how to control him. And I think part of Mole's like attraction is that she feels that she can like connect to him as well and be part of that.
Yeah.
And then she's there in white, and there are these fairy tale moment of them walking along the beach together in those contrasting outfits.
And I like that you said the duality, because I read the Variety review of this film, and there was a line that stood out that I really liked. And I think, who said it? Guy Lodge. The counteracting beauty implied by the title is certainly present, though perhaps not at all separate, not all that separate from its beasts, which I think is, when going back to the title, you know, who's the beast, who's the beauty? And I like that ambiguity and that duality that plays throughout, which is quite cool.
It actually gave me, like, thinking a bit of Lady Macbeth.
I can see that, the sort of elemental setting mixed with a kind of very conservative feel of the people within it,
And where that was taking quite a modern, progressive story and taking it into the past to give it new context. Like, Beast felt very classical, and taking a very old story and bringing it into a new context. But both got that quite, as you say, rugged, elemental feeling. And I could see, even down to the poster, I think Beast, it's Altitude they're releasing this.
Yes.
And they had such success with the Lady Macbeth campaign, and they've gone back to old reliable blue and yellow.
Blue and yellow, I was going to say,
But I could see this running a pretty similar kind of campaign to that.
I think you're right, I think they're aiming for that.
Also, blue and yellow was traditional for Beast's costume in the comics, so...
That's it, that's the last podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay, I think on what a note to end the discussion on Beast, which is out in cinemas today. Do go and check it out. But it's not the only film that you can be watching. There's obviously other stuff in the cinema, maybe big films involving hundreds of cast members. But there's also a little film called The Wound, which played at London Film Festival last year. It's going to be on Curzon Home Cinema from today. Kelly, you saw this a while back, yeah?
Yeah, I saw it at the LFF. It's an interesting film. I think there's been a lot of controversy around it, but it's definitely worth seeing. I'm very proud that it came out of South Africa, and I think it's dealing with things that like should be on screen.
What are those things?
It's dealing with sexuality in this very specific context, which is the Xhosa community. In the Eastern Cape in South Africa, and I think it's the classic tradition versus modernity. Like, it's a good film, people should watch it.
But it's not the only thing on Curzon Home Cinema. So we've actually just put up a Claire Denis collection, which has got Beau Travail, 35 Shots Around, White Material, and of course Let the Sunshine In, which was the focus of last week's episode. If you haven't heard that already, go back and listen. We've got Sophie Monks Kaufman on the show, contributing editor to Little White Lies, as well as an interview with Claire herself, which is really good fun. She does not mince her words, which I'm sure anyone that's read any of the interviews that she's been doing around this film will be very aware of. If you've got any thoughts on Beast for next week's show or any of our recent releases, so Let the Sunshine In and Custody, do email those in to podcast@curzon.com, as we would love to read them out. And if you haven't already subscribed to the show, you can do that on Acast and iTunes. Leave us a review or a comment. That would be really wonderful. Until next time, though, we'll have to say farewell. So it is farewell from Kelly Powell.
Goodbye.
Farewell from Josh Slater Williams.
Bye.
And farewell from the Beast from the East.
Farewell. Can we do that every week? Call me the Beast from the East.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.